This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Let's hit it. Give me a vacation.
Vacation.
Give me a wave.
Surfing.
Give me a city tour.
The trolley.
Give me animals.
The zoo.
Give me some sea life. Give me museums.
Balboa Park.
Give me a woo.
Roller coaster.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your family vacation at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about paella.
Yes, and thanks to Swati for the recommendation. I'm sure other people have recommended it in the past.
Sure, probably.
But this was the most recent recommendation. She actually recommended a whole series on rice dishes.
Ooh. Oh, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, which I think is a great idea. But speaking of, you can see our rice episode and also our risotto episode, I think, applies in kind of what we're talking about here. And our tomato episode, and our escargot episode.
Yeah, and there's even a couple more that are coming up in the outline. And our next one, super secret hint, is also going to be related to one of these ingredients.
What could it be? I don't know.
No. I think you do know.
Let me pretend that I don't know.
Okay, you definitely don't know.
Also, I just highly recommend the escargot episode because we got to talk about really weird biology stuff.
Yeah, it was. I think that was low key what inspired me to get aquatic snails as pets because I was like, these things are fascinating. So good.
Indeed.
I mean, tasty and fun, both.
Feasty and fun. It's an excellent description. Well, I don't have paella often at all. Probably less than I can count on one hand how many times I've had paella.
Oh, but, ever? Wow, heck.
Yeah. But I do love it. And I have a very fond memory of eating it when I went on a high school trip to France and Spain. That was the first time I'd been on a plane, first time I'd been somewhere international. So, has a high place in my memories, but we learned how to make gin and tonics, and yes, I was 16, and sangria, and I felt so cool. And then we had paella, and it was delicious.
I loved it. Oh goodness! I don't know. I don't think I had ever had paella until I moved here to Atlanta. There's a local chain of like Spanish-ish themed restaurants called La Fonda, and for a while I was like reiterating their paella a lot. Unfortunately, it's not something that I order out very often because sofrito is often an ingredient and bell peppers are often an ingredient in sofrito, and that's bad times for me. But oh, I love a paella. Any rice dish that has, well, A, any rice dish. B, any one pan rice dish that has the capacity to have like a layer of crispy on the bottom. Oh my heck. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah. When I was telling people I was doing this episode, because I live right near a La Fonda. So many people were like, you've got to get, because I was saying like, I need paella. The craving is so strong. And they were like, go to La Fonda. And so I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. That's in my future.
Oh yeah, do it.
But I want to include a Seinfeld quote of the episode. This is from Kramer. And he's describing Estelle Costanza's paella.
Okay.
Yes. And he says, oh, it's an orgiastic feast for the senses, a festival of sights, sounds, and colors. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I think that's about right.
It is a festival.
It is a festival for the soul, the taste, the heart.
Oh.
Everything.
Everything.
And people do have very strong thoughts about paella.
Oh my goodness, I didn't realize, but yes, it does bring us, I believe, to our question.
Indeed, paella. What is it?
Well, the specifics do depend on who you ask, but paella is a savory, pan-cooked, short to medium grain rice dish that also contains stuff.
Ooh, stuff.
Stuff, yes. That stuff can be all kinds of proteins and vegetables. The liquid that you add to cook the rice in there can be a water, broth, wine, a combination. Tomatoes and spices like saffron and paprika and rosemary are often added. It's meant to be a dish that, yeah, you cook in this single pan. You get your aromatics going, like the garlic and the onions in olive oil. Then cook off your vegetables and your proteins a little bit, get them nice and brown. Then add cooking liquid and rice in some order.
Mm-hmm.
Stir to combine, and then just kind of let it sit until it is cooked. You don't usually stir it that much after all of the ingredients are in there. And it's traditionally cooked over a hot wood fire in a shallow, two-handled iron pan. And this pan distributes, and the wood fire too, both distribute heat across all the ingredients throughout the pan, allows moisture to steam out. It allows that toasty crust of caramelized rice to form on the bottom of the pan. Oh, so good. In Spanish, it is called socarrat. So crunchy, so satisfying. So you wind up with this al dente rice, tender and comforting and carby, in either a reduced broth or with the liquid totally absorbed. Again, this is a preferential thing. And it just winds up either way being a bright and tangy sweet and warm and earthy savory. And there are so many opinions about what is the right way for it to be and what is the right way to cook it in order to arrive at that dish. You know, how much should you brown the ingredients before you add the cooking liquid? How much cooking liquid should you add? Do you want that socarrat or not? Do you toast the rice before you add the liquid? And then the ingredients, you know, like what goes into your aromatic vegetable mix? Is it a sofrito with bell peppers or without bell peppers? Is it okay to mix land and sea proteins? Should chorizo ever be in there? Someone gasped when I said that.
yes.
I mean, like, but what rices are appropriate? It goes on and on. Like, even stuff like onion and garlic and paprika are contested. I will say that paella valenciana, the traditional paella, typically contains as its veg string beans and lima beans, A, more connective tissue.
Yeah.
If you're going for land meats, then rabbit, chicken, and snails are common. If you're going the seafood route, usually you wouldn't do both at the same time. Shrimp, clams, mussels, crawfish, and squid are common. around Spain, depending on the time of year, artichoke hearts and white beans are sometimes found, but it tends to be like a more like the more simple, the better kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the versions that you get outside of Spain are not really considered. They're like, that's not paella, that's like rice with stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we're going to revisit, especially in, spoiler alert, there's a paella emoji. And a lot of conversation came up around, what is the paella emoji?
What should be included in it? Does it really look like paella?
Yes. Does it?
Well. One more hint of controversy on top of that, though. What time of day should paella be eaten? Mm. Is it okay to eat paella after sunset? I cannot tell you the answer to this question, but some people say no.
What am I going to do, Lauren? So I should eat it for lunch to be safe.
Lunch, yeah. Solid lunch.
All right, done. Easy. Well, what about the nutrition?
Of course, it depends on how you make it. It tends to be calorically dense. A good protein, light on the veg, heavier on the carbs and the fats. It is a meal that will fill you up and it will keep you going. As we always say, eat a vegetable. Maybe a nice light salad on the side. Don't take my word for that as being traditional. I just think you should eat a vegetable.
Lauren's just trying to look out for you.
I am. I just want your digestive system and,
she's thinking about your digestive system
balance to have a good time. I want your cellular structure to be everything it can be.
It's because you're so kind and thoughtful, Lauren.
This seriously keeps me up at night sometimes. I'm like not even kidding.
We do have a responsibility as very awkward, clearly not professional food podcasters to make sure people eat vegetable salads and
it's
the like.
Hard to eat food. I understand.
It's hard to eat food. Unless it's paella, then it's perhaps too easy.
True enough. Paella is one of the dishes that, like, if I have a pan of paella in front of me, I'm like, so this is a single serving, correct? Like, this is I will just keep eating until there is no more, and then I know to stop.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing, right, is usually you cook it in that big pan, and unless you're with a big group and it's just you, the paella.
Yep.
You need a group is what I'm saying.
Yes, preferably. Absolutely.
And we don't really have any numbers for you. I will say that in a lot of the articles I read, they said, any Spanish restaurant you go to is going to have a paella on the menu, whether or not that is something that traditionalist would call paella, or
right,
if it's just rice with stuff in it, as you said, which is a common complaint. That's not just you. Like,
yeah,
that is a common complaint thrown at some restaurants that it's not true paella. But basically, paella has sort of infiltrated our international psyche, whether it is real paella, or not.
It's also important to remember that whenever we're talking about an entire country, it's not going to be a culinary monolith. If you go to different areas of that country, there are going to be different local foods that have been traditionally incorporated into cuisines for different reasons. And so, yeah. So when you're talking about this concept of paella, it did originate in one specific place, and it's fine to have iterations.
Mm-hmm.
Iterate away.
And there are so many iterations. And we do have a lot of fun conversation around this and around technology around this, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. But first, we got to go through some history to get there.
We do. And we will get into that as soon as we get back from a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Mm-hmm. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if... No. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, paella was the confluence of a lot of things. It is sometimes described as the history of Spain on a plate.
Love it.
I do. I do, too. The olive oil was a result of Romans planting olive trees in the region. The tomatoes were brought back from Spanish colonization of the Americas. Rice arrived in Valencia via Arab traders and the North African Berbers that settled there in the 8th century. And rice took off particularly well there. In fact, Eros, and I know it, that's not correct. And I
Eros. Born, it's okay.
I'm bad at the double R. I can do it sometimes, but a lot of times it sounds really pretentious to me. And also I fail at it. So.
Okay. I think that was clear enough.
Thank you. I will take it. the Spanish word for rice derives from the Arabic word for rice. And in the early days, rice farmers in this region often ate easy and cheap rice, just rice on the weekdays. And on the weekends, they ate it as a complement to a stew with whatever was in season at the time. And irrigation systems built by the Romans in Valencia made the way for rice to become a staple in the local diet by the 15th century. And speaking of Romans, historians believe the pan used for paella, which is really important in this whole thing, originated with ancient Romans, and that the word paella comes from the Latin word for this type of pan, patella. In Valencian, it means frying pan or pan and is used for all kinds of pans. There's a romantic but widely dismissed story that the name was bestowed by a young man who made this dish for his lover, or paella, for her. Or that it comes from the Arabic word for leftovers, and more on why that is in a second.
Okay.
Yes. The pan and the rice came together in Valencia, and farmers, perhaps particularly rice farmers in that region, are thought to be the first to whip up paella. They'd add whatever they had available to the rice, cook it in a large, wide, thin-bottom pan. Of note, it might have been a convex pan, which is not the case today, but because they were doing it kind of over this open fire, not on like a stove or what we have more modernly to cook it over.
Right, more like a wok. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they would eat this for lunch. And they would put all kinds of things in there, from snails to onions to tomatoes, sometimes beans. They would season it with spices like saffron and paprika or paprika. And they'd mix all these flavors and textures into this dish. And at the time, snails were cheap, so they were the frequent choice for protein. But on special occasions, people might use rabbit or duck or chicken. And the traditional method for paella consumption was straight out of the pan with wooden spoons.
Yeah, yeah, like everyone like gather around the pan and have their own wooden spoon and would eat communally together. Yeah.
Yes. But in other versions of the story, paella resulted from servants that cooked at royal banquets, and they would take any leftovers and bring them home, cook them up over an open fire with rice. Again, this is probably a case of multiple instances of this happening.
Oh, sure. The area around Valencia was famed for its quality and quantity of agriculture at the time. You know, that good Spanish rice, freshwater fish and eels from a nearby lake, marine seafood from the nearby Mediterranean coast, lots of game birds, tomatoes, were introduced in Spain in the early 1500s. It seems that they were picked up more readily there than they were in Italy or England, which were like, what are these poison things? And the Spanish were like, they're tasty. And they were like, no! Sierra Tomato episode. Valencia is home to lime mines, not the fruit, you know, like the mineral. And thus, the water and ground there is infused with extra calcium compounds. And this can help some plants grow and can also help some of the animals that eat those plants grow. You can see our Kentucky / bourbon episodes for more on all of that. But some Valencian cooks swear that the calcium-rich local water is critical to the final texture of paella. And, like, if they're, like, going on, like a road trip to the mountains or something, they will bring local water with them if they're planning on cooking paella while they're away.
Yeah. I think I even read some restaurants in different countries.
Yeah, there's a rumor that there's been someplace in New York City, but like I've read that rumor in like 5 articles, but I've never read a name of such a restaurant. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a lovely concept. I enjoy it. and all of this local tradition and culture around paella as it was developing, the Spanish Empire was at work, you know, still colonizing overseas, including Louisiana in the mid to late 1700s. So one of the deep influences on area dishes like jambalaya is Spanish paella.
Mm-hmm. And one of Valencia's oldest restaurants, La Pepica, often comes up in conversation about paella. It opened in 1898 after King Alfonso XIII officially allowed 44 people to set up these small beachside restaurants.
Okay.
And many of these restaurants served paella, but a storm in 1924 destroyed most of them. And that's when La Pepica, in its current form, was constructed. So it existed before, but it got blown down. They rebuilt it, still standing. Its open kitchens influenced how observing chefs in that area cooked paella, because they could see in, see what they were doing.
Ah.
Yeah, knew this was a popular product. La Pepica has been in the family since it first opened its doors with the same recipes and cooking methods, and it often gets the credit for popularizing one of the most beloved types of paella, seafood paella. In fact, I'm sure some people would argue with me and say that they created it. I'm going to say popularized it.
Yeah, but. I would. I mean, yes. I suspect
it makes
that
sense.
Second thing. Right. It makes sense that other human people would have also put seafood in this thing. If
yes.
Seafood was what was available.
Yes, but I will absolutely agree that they popularized it.
Yeah.
And as part of that, other kitchens did take notice. And they started making their own versions of this seafood paella. And later, they also take credit for inventing vegetable paella. Again, I would say popularizing is probably better. Mm-hmm. But this, allegedly, they did in service of former vegetarian queen Sophia. So they were trying to make a vegetarian version for her.
For her, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And she's not the only famous name involved in this restaurant. We also have Ernest Hemingway, who shows up in a lot of our episodes,
so
I gotta say.
Dude just liked eating and drinking, you know? I respect it.
Mm-hmm. So he visited La Pepica a few times in 1959. He spoke really highly of it. He brought it into the international spotlight, and he wrote about it in his book, The Dangerous Summer, quote, "Dinner at Pepica's was wonderful. The seafood and the Valencian rice dishes were the best on the beach."
Ah.
I mean, that's high praise.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not the only famous patron either. There was also painter Joaquin Sorolla. One story goes that after observing this painter struggling to de-shell and peel the seafood in their seafood paella, the wife of the owner had observed this. And so the next time that he ate there, she peels and already shelled the seafood for him. So he didn't have to do it.
Huh.
And other restaurants took note of this too. And soon, quote, "gentleman's paella" gained popularity.
Okay, I will put in here. I can't help myself. If you're going to make paella at home and you do not at the table wish to de-shell or peel your seafood, but you're making a seafood paella, do cook the shells in the paella. It will add a lot of great extra flavor. Just do what this nice lady supposedly did.
Yes.
And remove before serving. Yeah, post-cooking.
Yes. So going back to that rice and stew thing that we were talking about earlier, the first recipes for that in this region popped up between the 1750s and 1800s, the first written recipes. And according to one source, the word paella wasn't used to refer to the food as opposed to the pan, which it was used mm-hmm. for. But the food specifically, that didn't happen until the 1840s. In an article about this regional dish, but references to rice a la Valencia date back to the 17th century, and we can guess that that was similar at least.
Mm-hmm.
By the mid-20th century, it was a popular foodstuff for laborers, this paella. Before that, it was primarily eaten at family gatherings, and it still was, but kind of mm-hmm. spread out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Paella really vaulted to the world stage in the 20th century. After the 1975 death of Franco, the dictator that had ruled the country for 36 years, much of the country celebrated. And that caught the eye of tourists, something only amplified by the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. And as a part of marketing Spanish culture to tourists, chefs really showcased paella, often in conjunction with tourism boards. And this transformed paella from a regional dish to a symbol of Spain, something tourists expected to encounter when visiting the country. And this, in turn, led to real confusion about what the dish actually was. And there were a mess of interpretations and watered-down versions, just a lot of confusion. So, to combat this, a group of Valencians came together, ranging from chefs to writers to just outright fans, in 2013 to found Wiki Paella, with the goal of protecting and preserving this culinary heritage for Valencians themselves. They published a 10-point manifesto, an app, a map to find paella, a breakdown of ingredients they compiled after consulting 200 restaurants in Valencia, which you can reference. Like, if you're like, I want paella with this in it, you can search it. It's great. A bunch of stuff. And in their about section, it reads, today, paella, in addition to being the fundamental axis of the gastronomic tradition of the Valencian community, has become an attractive world brand that is often misunderstood. Wiki Paella is the organized response of the public to this imbalance between what is believed to be and what it really is. A source of knowledge and recognition around authentic paellas made by everyone. One of the key members of the team working at Wiki Paella, Jose Manuel Garcera, explained some of the difficulties they face. Quote, we realize the lack of understanding is as much our fault as anyone's. We can't even come to an agreement ourselves what constitutes real paella. So how can we expect the rest of the world to? In a radius of 60 kilometers, you'll find four very distinct paellas. Someone might say, I'm sorry, that's not a paella. What the hell are you talking about? That's how my grandpa always made it.
Oh, I love this with, it feels like every dish we talk about has this type of history of disagreement and just impassioned, like, no, like, that is not how my grandparents made it, so you are wrong. And to this end, there was, in fact, a Paellagate hashtag back in 2016 that I believe was kicked off by English celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, offering and then defending a paella that included chorizo. The thing with chorizo is that it's a strong flavored ingredient. And so a lot of like paella purists, I think, would say that it's going to overwhelm the delicacy of the other ingredients. Be overpowering. So you know, if you need to read up on Paellagate, it's a really fun, bizarre rabbit hole. I found all of these articles talking about like terrible versions of paella that celebrity chefs had made. It was like, and another thing, Gordon Ramsay. And I'm like, aw.
Yeah, and I think that was another thing on Wiki Paella is they said, like, everyone's going to say that their family recipe is the best. Like, you can say this restaurant, you might agree, is doing a really good version, but your family recipe
is going to be the best.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Of course.
Of course.
Food nostalgia is powerful.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of, like, weird rabbit holes, I guess, in 2015, Guillermo Navarro and his ad agency were looking to promote one of their clients, a client that dealt in rice. So they decided to embark on a paella emoji mission.
Oof.
Yeah. And he called up Spanish chef Jose Andres for help, who later said of the whole thing, you can't just pay these guys off. You have to convince them that paella emoji is something that people will really use, that it is really important. So Andres really wanted the emoji to reflect true paella and not just rice with stuff on it. So the emoji was greenlit in January 2016, and this was after the hashtag paella emoji trended in March 2015 with 20,000 tweets that reached 35 million people. Still, when the emoji came out in December 2016, Navarro was none too happy. It had peas, shrimp, and mussels.
Peas. Peas.
So Navarro went right to the source, the inventor of the first emoji in Japan. Yes, he flew there.
Wow.
He flew there about this paella emoji. And his determination paid off. I read he gave a lot of impassioned speeches. Yeah. And the emoji was updated in April 2017, or at least it was for Apple. Some other platforms lagged behind, and Andres later said, "I'm so upset at Bill Gates. Microsoft is the worst of the worst ones because, well, you look at this paella emoji and you don't even know what it is."
Wow.
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates.
He also called out Zuckerberg.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
See, okay, I'm looking through my phone's emoji right now, and what I can guess is meant to maybe be paella. Looks like just like a hot pot to me, maybe like a curry. It isn't the right type of pan with the two handles.
Yeah.
But it's got like a chicken drumstick and green beans and are those lemons? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, no, it is lemons. Well, that's what it's supposed to be, lemon. Because Andres fought against that too. He was like, "I'm not sure why they put the lemon in there, but that's the best we can get. I will take it." The green beans are supposed to be in there for sure.
Yeah, yeah, they are. They are. And it is, to be fair, clearly green beans. and a dark meat on the bone chicken is certainly not unheard of in a paella. So I feel like it's halfway there. I feel like...
Yeah.
It doesn't scream paella to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would scream paella to you?
You know, I think of the seafood type. Also, I think that you really have to have the texture of the grains of rice apparent. And I know that you're dealing in a very small medium here, so detail is difficult. But one of the things that I kept reading about over and over again is how important it is for the rice to be dry, like individual grains, not sticky or mushy or swampy. I think that's the first time I've ever applied swampy as a term to a food dish. And I hope it's the last. I never want to think about that again. Anyway, which is why it looks more like a pot of curry or something to me in my Apple emoji bank.
Yeah, I texted Lauren last night and I was like, "Is this the paella emoji?" Just sort of randomly. So I was curious. It's what, when I typed in paella, that's what came up as an emoji.
Oh, okay. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Huh.
I think that's it.
I mean, there's no alternative that is more paella than that.
Oh, I love how often we get to talk about emojis in here.
It's an important part of our modern cultural landscape, you know?
It's true. Yeah, and food is a big part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll keep tabs on what happens with the paella emoji in the future.
We will.
But yeah, that's about what we have to say on paella for now.
It is. We do have some listener mail for you, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
oldest girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by oldest girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener Mail.
Oh, that was lovely.
Was it?
I thought it was. And I have the last say on this listener mail bit.
You do.
So there, it was lovely, Lauren.
Gong gong. Yeah.
Anthony wrote, Ice Wines. When I lived in Massachusetts, my father created a tradition of traveling to Stowe, Vermont in August to attend an annual car show. When people hear Stowe, they think of a ski town, which it is, having the best slopes in the region. But Stowe is also wonderful in the summer. We continued this tradition until I was of age to drink, and then we started exploring other areas around Stowe. And one of these trips, we found the winery Boyden Valley in Cambridge, Vermont, just past Smuggler's Notch. Everything they offer here is amazing. To make the story shorter, we continued my father's tradition well past his death and extended it to my family with my wife and children until we moved to Florida. Boyden Valley continues to be our favorite winery, and we order from them over the internet. They boldly try new things and use the Vermont region to make unique and very appetizing wine. As much as I love grape wines, they make astounding blueberry, strawberry, discontinued, cranberry, and even rhubarb wines. Their ice wines are also immaculate, and I suggest you try them if you want to enjoy an experience better than what you had at Disney.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm into it.
Yeah.
I am into it.
Absolutely. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I've got family from up around nearish there, like the New Hampshire, Vermont sort of region. But I haven't done a whole lot of exploring. Usually when we're hanging out, we're, you know, just doing real tight family kind of stuff. So,
Oh, now I want to.
Yes, yes. I've teetered on the edge of getting some ice wine. I found like three or four in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah?
In Atlanta, and I'm like, oh.
I definitely have not been out to a store that would have it since we were talking about it. But when I go, who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? Only time can tell.
Absolutely. Oh, heck. Kristen wrote, I had to write as I listened to the Scrapple episode. I grew up in Dover, Delaware, and Scrapple was always in our fridge, and I just assumed the rest of the world was as fortunate as I in that respect. I eventually learned that was sadly not the case, and I've had to explain what it is and how much I love it to many over the years. My favorite way to eat it as a kid was in a sandwich of buttered toast and ketchup. Now it's with a runny egg on top. The trick is to cut just the right thickness in a slice so that the outside gets super crisp while the inside stays soft. There's a popular flea market and Amish food market in Dover called Spence's, and lines for their Scrapple egg and cheese on a roll sandwiches are often very long. My brother also tells me there's a local pizza place that offers Scrapple as a topping, though I have yet to try it. I currently live in central Pennsylvania, and while Scrapple is certainly a thing here, I've even had several homemade versions over the years. The brand I grew up eating, called Kirby and Holloway, out of Harrington, Delaware, is not available, and no other kind I've ever had comes close to it. It's dark and spicy and just the best. So, to answer your question, Lauren, yes, you can have it shipped, which I have done in times of desperation. Otherwise, whenever I go home for a visit, I always return with several pounds to tide me and my kids over. Piece of advice, if you want to stock up and freeze some, slice it first and lay the slices out on a cookie sheet to freeze, then store them in a freezer bag. Or if you're like me and storing a lot, vacuum seal in smaller portions to keep it extra fresh. You can put the frozen slices directly into a hot pan and they turn out great every time. If you freeze the whole block and then thaw, it'll be mealy.
Oh, I want this so badly. Oh, my gosh.
This is one of the joyous things about doing a food show is that I not infrequently have cravings for foods that I've never had. Yeah. And I have had Scrapple, but, like, I haven't had, like, that particular. I'm like, it just sounds so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And I love, as I've alluded to in past episodes, I love like regional pizza toppings.
Yeah.
And I love that there's a place that you can get Scrapple as a pizza
beautiful.
Topping.
Beautiful.
It really is. It really is. Well, one day.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, thanks to both of those listeners for writing to us. Mm-hmm. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We are also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks as always to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit Pronamel.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.